Now let's stay tuned. We have the second hour of the Dr. and Mrs. Future show right here on KSCO.
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. Ladies and gentlemen, KSCO presents the Dr. Future Show. If you would like to join in our show today, you can call us at 831-479-1080. That's 831-479-1080. And now, your host, Dr. Future.
Hey, folks, welcome back to the show. In the interest of keeping you informed, understanding COVID from the point of view of Dr. Tom Yarema, our special integrative medicine professional. He's worked in emergency rooms. He's been involved with international foreign relief work. He's worked with indigenous healers, and he also has a Western medical degree, and combined to give us a more of a full perspective understanding of who he is and what this whole thing is about. So welcome, Dr. Yarema.
Thank you so much, Dr. Future.
Yes, you're welcome.
My regards to the Mrs. Future as well.
Yes, and Mrs. Future is here. And also, you can thank Taylor Barcroft, who's on the line as well, our regular contributor for all things Apple.
Yeah, absolutely, Taylor.
Yeah,
happy birthday to you once again.
And we have Bobby Wilder.
Thank you.
And also, we have in San Francisco, Bobby Wilder, our science correspondent, who is very interested in you.
I'm a big fan of Bobby's. He does a lot to keep me updated and informed.
Oh.
Wonderful researcher.
Oh, yes. We're so glad to have him here with us as well. So, Dr. Tom, we'd like you to bring our KSCO audience up to speed and what you've learned about COVID yourself. And, you know, we're hearing all these stories about variants and vaccines, and we're kind of curious as to where you stand on these things.
Well, it's a wonderful question. I think that the last 10 months, and actually, let's see, this is January. So, yes, I started tracking data on COVID long before it came to our continent. I was tracking it while it was still in China, thanks to Google Translator and thanks to my background both in Western allopathic medicine as well as my background in traditional Chinese medicine.
Yes.
I was able to track it while it was still in Wuhan from both the Western medical perspective in Wuhan as well as the traditional Chinese medicine perspective in
so
Wuhan.
You think it came from the Wuhan Institute of Virology?
Well, you know, I think that there's going to be a lot of conjecture, and I think that the story will end up going down in the archives right next to who killed JFK.
Yeah.
In terms of where it came from. The reality is that one of the things that I think COVID has taught us is to be in the present, and to look into the future so that our purposeful actions, our kind words, could create a world in the present of the future that we all desire.
Well said.
And I think that that's been probably the biggest lesson for me, and the lesson that I think that this pandemic is endeavoring to teach us.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the right approach for fear is kindness.
Yes, and as I tell my patients, the correct escape from anxiety is actually purposeful action. And so from where do we derive our purposeful actions? That gets into our value systems and what we desire for what's truly important to us or to our loved ones or to our families. And whether we have been whitewashed with a terrible, terribly fatal pandemic, which we in Santa Cruz fortunately have not had, but other places of the nation like New York City have, or areas of Italy have, you know, what's remained sacrosanct is the connection between family members and close intimates. And even during lockdown, that's what's persisted. And that's still what's challenging us in this day and age, now some 10 months later or so, is how well do we manage our relationships with those that are closest to us?
Good point.
Zoom.
Also, yeah. Dr. Yarema, I'd like to ask you to just back off from the mic a little bit because we're getting a little pop when you're saying P's and T's and things like that. So just a little further from the mic.
From your understanding of pandemics, how does this compare to, say, the one that happened 100 years ago? Are Americans suffering any less today compared to then? What's your understanding?
That's a great question. From my research into the Spanish flu epidemic, it was a pandemic. It was worldwide. Mm-hmm. And it was an influenza virus. Is that at that time, there was the mortality rate, which was much, much higher. In those 2 years, it's estimated that 10 to 15% of the human population of the planet died. And if you go into Harvey West Park, into their cemetery, it's amazing how many 1919, 1920, 1921 deaths you'll find there. And that's true of any American cemetery. And it really underscores this tremendous increase in actual deaths above the norm during that 2.5 year period. If we look at data in the last year, we have had a very small percentage of excess deaths compared to, say, the last 5 years running. And that number has only been about 3 to 4. I haven't even seen anything reported as high as 5%. So some people are reporting as low as 2.8, but I think it's more in the 3 to 3.5% increase in excess deaths over previous years running.
Is this overall deaths in the country?
We have such good statistics on this that the weekly excess death count has become part of what different countries around the world have monitored as how they are faring with their whatever maneuvers, whatever policies they're putting in place within their own geographic boundaries to try to see what's working and what's not working.
Well, help me out here with the excess death. And is that
after the break? Because we really have to go to our first break and then excess deaths when we get back.
All right. We'll be right back.
With Dr. Tom Urima on the Dr. Future Show. And Mrs. Schultz. Thanks.
Bobby and Taylor, too. Welcome back to the show. We're on with Dr. Tom Urima talking about COVID. Dr. Tom, you're talking about excess deaths, and I guess the excess deaths reflect how many more deaths are actually are caused by COVID worldwide.
Excess deaths means, are we having more people dying this week, this month, this year, than we did on average a year ago as a fraction of total population? So we factor out population growth, or if a country has actually a decrease in their population over a year.
Yeah.
And we see, are the same number of people dying? And then that gives us excess deaths.
Mm-hmm. And so what does it look like worldwide on this? Has there been a jump in excess deaths?
Not a jump, but about a 3.5% increase.
3.5 over last year.
So that's a small jump. There was a rather large jump at the very beginning of the pandemic, and that actually defined the pandemic. When we see a sudden spike in weekly excess deaths, then that defines that there is a pandemic or an endemic going on. And then we start to look for, well, what is that? Is that motorcycle accidents? Is it poisoning? Is it air pollution and asthma deaths in the ER? Or is it something else?
And when did this happen for COVID? Last March?
Well, that's kind of shady information. It happened actually in December in Wuhan, because the world's greatest virologists, the two world's greatest virologists, Professor Chang, Z-H-A-N-G, and Dr. Holmes, who's an Aussie that works out of London, they received on January 2nd or 3rd bronchial washings. That's someone putting a bronchoscope, an endoscopic fiber optic telescope, into people's lungs and washing out the fluid, and then trying to isolate what was causing a very strange pneumonia. And so they got about 10 samples from 10 different patients of bronchial washings on January 2nd or 3rd, all from Wuhan. And they identified this novel virus in 8 out of 10 bronchial washings. So that was January 3rd. Hmm. Through the miraculous capabilities of mega computers and artificial intelligence, the entire genome, 30,000 base pairs, which is, I think there's less than 10,000 in an HIV virus, mm-hmm. but the entire genome of this new virus that had never been seen before were identified within 5 days. Hmm. So between January 3rd and January 10th, Dr. Zhang and Dr. Holmes had done something that had never been done before in human scientific history, and that was completely define the genome of a completely new virus that was obviously causing a outbreak within the town of Wuhan.
And it was isolated and mapped by early January.
Yes, by very early January. And then on January 10th, and this is actually a historical moment, because the two of them sat on this information for 48 hours and they said, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? And of course, there was a lot of political pressure within China already to suppress this information. Mm-hmm. But Dr. Zhang and Dr. Holmes, they knew that they were sitting on a time bomb. So they agreed to release to the world. They posted the entire genome of the virus on January 10th on the National Institute of Health's Gene Bank and then tweeted to everyone in the world. And so this is probably the most famous tweet to ever occur on Twitter was January 10th by Dr. Holmes saying that he and Dr. Zhang had published open data, open source data of the entire genome of this new novel virus that was causing disease that had never been seen before at an explosive rate.
In Wuhan.
And that's when all of the machinery of scientific research began.
In Wuhan.
And around the world. Well,
actually, worldwide. Like, worldwide. For example, Moderna started working on their vaccine within 2 hours after that tweet.
Wow. 2 hours. My goodness.
Within 2 hours.
Amazing.
So we have seen more scientific collaboration internationally than ever in the history of humankind.
Yes.
Interestingly, it's not been scientific collaboration for space exploration or for global climate solutions. It's been scientific collaboration to quell a pandemic. Mm-hmm. And has not evolved into a pandemic as severe as the Spanish flu has. And now what we're doing is we have different countries have tried different things in terms of social distancing or masks or whatever. And the holy grail has always been vaccine in these situations.
Yes.
But what we've seen most recently is some science that has come to bear that it appears to me as a practicing physician that we may have something that will either be adjunctive to the vaccine or that may even be a more feasible solution to hastening the end of the pandemic while we're waiting for safety and effectiveness data on the vaccines that are being developed.
Would that be what I am most excited about. Really? Would that be ivermectin by any chance?
This is ivermectin, yes.
Oh, great. That's a word that gets you thrown off of Twitter these days, but certainly among the word of mouth network that we're a part of, it's been very much of interest.
We have some questions for you on ivermectin, as a matter of fact. Yeah. Is it true that ivermectin was finally approved as an emergency COVID treatment?
Well, it didn't need to be approved as an emergency treatment because it was already FDA approved.
For use in other applications.
Yes. So this is where we're living in a cultural age of misinformation. And hopefully, now that we have moved through the most recent political chapter in the last week or so, that we can begin to dispel a lot of the confusion that misinformation has spun. So the Food and Drug Administration approves medications on the basis of safety and effectiveness, and then for labeling of the bottles, so that you and I, if we go to the drugstore and we buy aspirin, we get aspirin inside that bottle. Okay, so they regulate labeling, and that is based upon safety and effectiveness. Now, the third tier that the FDA is involved in is actually dosage. Now, that's very different than vaccines. Vaccines operate outside of that normal progression of safety, effectiveness, and then dosing. Scientifically, we do go through that same thing. But in this particular era of this pandemic, I certainly saw a lot more data and a lot more information on supposed effectiveness of a vaccine before I saw any safety data. And one would say, well, that's because the federal government, the NIH, the FDA, the CDC, whoever the decision makers are, and I think it's ultimately the FDA, granted emergency use authorization for two vaccines. So when those get rolled out, we have some animal studies. We have very, very small human studies that are done on very, very select patients that are not representative of the general population. And so then that gets rolled out and it gets tested. It's actually experimental testing on humans.
Right.
Now, if that was a drug, the individual would have to sign an informed consent for experimental testing.
But with a vaccine?
But in this situation, the patients of mine that I've spoken to that have received the vaccine, they did not sign an informed consent for experimental testing. They did go through a checklist of potential risk factors that might portend an adverse reaction to the vaccine, but they were not informed that they were going through experimental testing, nor did they sign an informed consent for experimental testing. So we are now at the point where we've administered a number of 200 million dosages of vaccine in the United States. I believe we're in that realm right now.
I think that sounds high. I think that they are manufacturing 100 million doses and that they're trying to administer 1 million a day now.
Yes, but I think the total number that have been administered in the United States so far is right around 200 million from both manufacturers. And I know that in the last week and a half, the California state epidemiologist urged the blocking of 300,000 dosages of 330,000 dosages of a particular manufacturer that was delivered to our state because of a cluster of adverse effects in nurses in San Diego County. This is not unusual with a rollout of a vaccine. With a rollout in vaccine, we're treating extremely large numbers of people. Classically, we say to achieve herd immunity with a vaccine, we need to vaccinate about 70 to 80% of the population in a close time span. And because we're doing this for a very, very aggressive infectious disease.
Yeah, Tom, can you hold that thought for a second? We got to go to a commercial break.
Okay.
Can you hold on?
Sorry to interrupt you. It's so important.
Yes.
We'll be right back.
Appreciate your download.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Dr. and Mrs. Future Show with our guest, Dr. Tom Urema, who brings the best of the naturopathic and allopathic medicine understanding to our discussion today of issues around vaccinations, the coronavirus, et cetera, et cetera. And Dr. Tom, you were just saying some really fascinating things about the normal issues that would be of concern to the NIH trying to deal with a pandemic at this time, such as trying to administer as many vaccinations as possible during a certain window of time. Maybe you want to just pick up where you left off.
Yes. So with a typical vaccine rollout for an acutely exploding infectious disease, statistically, we model that 70 to 80% of the population should be vaccinated. In this particular circumstance, we have a new and novel organism. So we have invented new and novel vaccines, and they are being rolled out. They're being rolled out as an experimental trial, as under the emergency use authorization. And when we're trying to vaccinate 70 or 80% of the population of an entire country or an entire planet, we do expect adverse events, we do expect deaths, but we weigh those deaths versus what we hope to achieve with that therapy. Hmm. Now, what I'm more excited about than the vaccine is that throughout this pandemic, we've talked about, and even on this show, when I spoke previously about, are there ways that we can induce natural herd immunity or augmented herd immunity while we're waiting?
If you're a first responder, you should go ahead with this. Do you think the vaccination with the existing vaccine would be a good course? Our health officials are on the right course with that, in your opinion?
Well, in terms of me recommending or not recommending, first of all, any information that I'm saying right now is for informational and educational purposes only. It should not be construed as medical advice. Thanks. Vaccination or not vaccination should be done on an individualized basis.
Right. Yes.
We certainly want to protect first responders. We want to protect our vulnerable. We want to protect our teachers and our healthcare workers, our cashiers in the grocery store. And the use of ivermectin, science has now informed us that this is very valuable for both treatment and for prevention. And we have established safety data on the use of ivermectin, where we do not have large population studies of safety data on our vaccines yet.
When do you see it being useful? After you've tested positive?
No, I think that ivermectin could be useful for every single individual over the age of 15, and it can be safely prescribed. The FDA has empowered all physicians to prescribe ivermectin off-label. Hmm. It's up to that physician to determine appropriate dosage and appropriate dose scheduling, how many times a day, for how many days in a row, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And any doctor who has educated himself on the international data, where it has been rolled out for large public health initiatives, can determine in their own mind a dosage and a dosage schedule. I'm doing that in my practice. And what we have seen, what science informs us, is that mm-hmm. ivermectin saves lives, it saves hospitalizations, it decreases symptoms, especially when used early. And when used early, even if the family members that are using it early for what we call post-exposure prophylaxis or post-exposure protection, and I'll give you a little picture. So let's say I have a family of four, and one of my family members tests positive because someone they were exposed to outside the house tested positive. And then my family member not only tests positive, but they actually come down with COVID. Now all the other three family members deserve post-exposure protection. Mm. So when ivermectin was used for post-exposure protection, the other family members would have milder symptoms than expected, and their intimate contacts would also seroconvert. That is, they would develop antibodies. Mm. So what we're seeing is we have a pharmaceutical drug that decreases symptoms for both late and severe disease, as in ICU hospitalized patients on ventilators. It's also appropriate for early symptoms. And if taken early, it certainly has a rapid turnaround of symptoms in the majority of cases. This has been scientifically and statistically documented in at least 8 different countries. And the research has now been repartitioned and identified through meta-analysis. The research has been sent to the NIH in the last 2 weeks, and the NIH has acknowledged that this data is worth serious inquiry, and they are waiting for a data feed of 4 additional randomized controlled clinical trials, and it's also being reviewed by the World Health Organization.
So how's the supply of ivermectin? Is that going to be, if it's approved, then there's going to be a huge demand for it, if there isn't
That's
already.
That's exactly right. And we saw this same issue with hydroxychloroquine several months ago.
Yeah.
So I, in my own practice, what I did was I secured for my patients the largest supply of ivermectin that exists in the United States through one particular mail order pharmacy. Now, patients can get ivermectin from any local retail pharmacy, but in the last week, week and a half, a lot of the prescriptions that I've written, those patients have gone to the local retail pharmacies and they've been told that they cannot fill them. They don't have stock in hand.
Yeah, it's already
We've
running.
Been able sure, to continue yeah. to supply through the mail order pharmacy that I have been in contact with.
They and still have supplies. So.
Yes, and we're not even close to exhausting that.
All right. So local safety measures are available.
Well, no.
That's what I'm using.
Yeah. Okay, so there's a lot to ask about ivermectin, but there's one question that has come in on the vaccine. Someone wants to know, what did Dr. Fauci mean when he said update to the vaccine?
I don't know what he meant. We would have to ask him directly, but I think that what we're going to see is because, for example, ivermectin is what we call a non-specific antiviral medicine. It doesn't really care so much about how the COVID virus is mutating.
So it could work with many different...
The vaccines are highly specific.
Right.
And as the virus mutates, some of the vaccines will become ineffective. For example, Merck in the last week pulled out of vaccine development completely. They were developing 2 different vaccines and they pulled out, and now Merck is only developing antiviral drugs because the 2 vaccines that they were developing and the way in which the virus is mutating, they've lost traction. Their vaccine is no longer effective.
Oh, man.
Obsolete.
No, ivermectin, no, wasn't it also used in veterinarian uses, like a deworming drug for dogs?
Yes, ivermectin was discovered in the early 70s. Mm-hmm. And it was discovered, interestingly, in Japan when a soil culture seemed to provide probiotic effects, and certain mammals that were, I think it was mice, would not get certain worms when they were eating, foraging and whatnot in the area of the soil. So they actually isolated a bacterium that had certain chemicals in it that provided this anti-parasitic effect. So ivermectin was initially approved for the worst parasitic infections in third world countries.
Wow.
Since that time, it's been used from everything like river blindness and lymphocytic filariasis all the way down to scabies and head lice.
Huh.
And the World Health Organization gave it a designation of one of the most essential medications, right up there with aspirin and penicillin.
So it's in every doctor's kit when you travel.
It should be, yes, exactly. Oh. And what's very fascinating is back in the, I think it was about 1986, the head person at the World Bank, Robert McNamara, looking all around the globe, he said, you know what, we have a big economic debility in Africa because of this one particular cause of blindness. More than 50% of people 50 years of age or older are blind because of something that we call river blindness. And this was a parasite carried by flies that would land on your eyelashes, land on your eyebrows while you were sleeping. Your eye would become infected and you would become blind.
Oh, wow.
And he said, we should take care of this. And so what happened over about 8 years is all the major players worldwide got together and they created an initiative to blanket the continent of Africa with ivermectin, and it eliminated river blindness.
Wow, incredible.
And it was a philanthropic Merck and Company, the drug manufacturer, gave the drug out for free.
Wow. Listen, we got to go to a break.
A philanthropic effort that blanketed a continent, reversed an endemic disease.
We'll be right back.
Okay, welcome back. We're talking to Dr. Tom a little bit about the history of ivermectin, which looks like it'll be a very useful compound in dealing with our pandemic here. Now, we were looking at philanthropic uses of ivermectin in the past. Could you just recap that last story for an audience in case people are just joining us?
Yes, so ivermectin is fascinating was that it was the African Program for Onchocerciasis Control, which is river blindness, and Merck Company agreed to give free ivermectin to the entire continent of Africa for as long as it took to eliminate the leading cause of blindness on that continent. That was in 1996. And in 2015...
That's the deworming element of it.
And its founders won the Nobel Prize in Medicine because of conquering the leading cause of blindness that, according to the head of the World Bank, was the leading cause of economic disability on the entire continent of Africa, blindness.
Wow.
And the flies were caused by a worm in the...
No, the flies transmitted the worm. And so when they landed on eyebrows and eyelashes and bit at it, the individual, then the worm would go into the skin and cause the parasitosis.
Right.
And so it was an infectious disease carried by flies. We're now dealing with an infectious disease of a virus. It's transmitted in air droplets, water droplets, spread by talking, even more than sneezing and coughing in most cases. It's protracted contact with people talking in close proximity.
So how does ivermectin kill the virus?
Well, it's interesting. The mechanism of action is actually multi-pronged, and there's a lot of theories on that. But what isn't theory, what's hard science, is its effectiveness in its use for late disease, for early disease, and in prevention. And so the way I'm using it in my clinic is I'm offering it for prevention, but a lot of people don't want to take a synthetic pharmaceutical for prevention. They'll take vitamin C, they'll take vitamin D3, they'll take zinc, they may take quercetin and feel good that they're preventing things. But if they are people that are at high risk of severe illness because of age, because of chronic inflammation, because of type 2 diabetes, because of hypertension, then I urge them, I say, especially through this flu season, please take the dosage that I recommend for you on the dosage schedule, which is just a Monday, Wednesday, Friday dose. And that way you will be protected even if you're exposed by an asymptomatic carrier. Now, you may not be protected 100%, but what science has informed us is that the symptoms and the severity of your disease will be much less. Ivermectin absolutely saves lives. It absolutely saves hospitalizations.
And I wanted to say, since you mentioned the idea of exposure from asymptomatic people, that they are claiming that you can't be sure with the vaccine, that even with the vaccine, you can't be sure that you, being asymptomatic, are not going to be infecting others. So in any case, it makes sense to take precautions for yourself.
And one of the good questions that comes up is there any interaction between ivermectin and the vaccines? And
that's a great question.
We have seen none. And from a theoretical viewpoint, we do not expect any either. So I don't think that we're at a point where it's an either or. I think it makes logical sense to do A plus B, especially if B is deemed safe and appropriate, B being the vaccine. So ivermectin, we have good safety data on. We have good effectiveness data on. It's up to the doctor's discretion on the dosage and the dosing schedule. I've arrived at that for my patients, and we've put that into test, and no one has had any side effects from the dosage.
It works okay with D3. If you're taking, what about if you're taking a full regimen of C and D, as well as ivermectin and quercetin, I think is a very common one here in Santa Cruz.
No problem.
No problem? So it works well with...
No problem. You can't even tell you're taking ivermectin. It's completely... There's no side effects or anything.
But you wouldn't take ivermectin and the vaccine, right?
Yeah,
I think one could.
Yeah.
There's no theoretic red flags on that, and we have no evidence of any exaggerated immune response. The greatest danger with the vaccine is that someone has a very exaggerated immune response after the vaccine is administered.
Mm-hmm.
And
like anaphylactic shock or something.
Actually works in the other way, where it acts as an anti-inflammatory and prevents the cytokine storm that is typical in the late stages of COVID.
Wow.
It prevents the cytokine storm. Wow.
Well, I won't say prevent. It mitigates it. Mitigates it, and it mitigates the chain of events that leads to that.
This is so interesting because
Oh, Bobby has a question
for
you, too.
In the last week, there was a patient hospitalized in the ICU, put on a ventilator. The ICU doctor treated her with ivermectin. She got better. She got off the ventilator. She was transferred from the ICU to a medical ward. The different doctor taking care of her in the medical ward failed to continue the ivermectin. The patient got worse. The patient had to go back on a ventilator. The family members sued the hospital for not continuing her ivermectin. And the hospital came back and said, listen, we don't dictate how doctors prescribe medicine. Dr. A may prescribe medicine differently than Dr. B. We can't do that. Mm. It went all the way to the New York Supreme Court judge, and the judge ruled that the hospital had to continue the initial ivermectin. The ivermectin was reinstituted. The patient came off the ventilator a second time and was then discharged from the hospital.
Wow. That's a great story. That'll give people hope.
Yes, I think that we've been living in helplessness and hopelessness, and we've been confused and anxious and frightened for a long time. Mm. And I can say that, and actually this is just very personally, in the, Tuesday afternoon. On Friday afternoon, an acupuncturist that used to work out of my clinic years ago called me up, and I could hardly understand what he was saying because he was coughing, he was gasping, he was wheezing, and he was short of breath. I finally understood him to say that he had been diagnosed with COVID pneumonia. Mm. And so I said, give me your family member on the phone. I said, it's 2:30 now. By 4:30, I want you to come to the clinic. I'm going to give your family member a package to bring home. I want you to start taking it immediately. And I just spoke to him hours ago from Friday afternoon until Tuesday midday today. He's 85% better. And he'd been
almost like a normal flu
14 days before he called me.
Okay,
what's your take on testing?
Well, I think testing is valuable to the epidemiologists. I do not think it's been... I was the first physician to offer in-office testing in Santa Cruz, and I abandoned it because of the false positives and false negatives. I had patients that were very, very clearly, in my mind as a clinician, COVID pneumonias.
The PCR tests?
CAT scans that were exact, and the testing was off. Mm. So I've abandoned testing. I think that COVID pneumonia is a clinical diagnosis. I think testing has its role, but I think it's been leveraged to create health policy, and that's not... I don't think that that's... a wise metric to follow for that.
Is your experience the PCR test is inaccurate, as we've been hearing?
To be perfectly honest, I've quit doing testing out of my office several months ago. So I treat patients clinically more commonly. If a patient comes in, like for example, I had a patient come in a week ago and said, I have COVID. And I said, do you have symptoms? And she said, I think I had headaches. I think I have a fever. I think I'm achy. And I go, why do you think that your headaches, fever, and achiness is COVID? They said, well, my son tested positive.
And I saw the news last night.
And I said, did you get your symptoms before or after your son told you he tested positive? I got my symptoms after my son told me. But my son's best friend who tested positive now has COVID. So I think that we have to recognize that we've been swimming in a bubble of helplessness, confusion, anxiety, and fear for so many months that ivermectin is the hope. Ivermectin delivers on the hope. Ivermectin is based in solid science. And now what we're struggling with is getting this into the consciousness of doctors so that they will more readily prescribe it.
Yeah. So could you ask your personal physician to just prescribe? What would it take for them to say
this? You absolutely can. And it is completely within his legal right and his empowerment by the California State Medical Board to write a prescription for that.
Huh.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Dr. Tom. Wow, what a reassuring show and so much useful information. I really appreciate it.
He's got a Zoom meeting coming up at 5.
Yeah, is the public invited?
Yes, every Tuesday, 5 p.m. It's called Zoom Open Clinic Hour, and anyone can easily connect to that just by going to drtom.com/Zoom and then following the blue buttons. You don't need the Zoom meeting room. You don't need a password. Just drtom.com/Zoom and follow the blue buttons, and
perfect.
I will see your smiling face.
Okay, well, thank you so much for your time and information. Really
thank
appreciate
you, Dr.
it.
Dr. Tom. Yeah,
yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
All right, best to everyone.
Take care.
Dr. and Mrs. Future.
Thank you, Dr. Tom Urema.
Enjoy the storm.
Yeah. That's it for
that's
another
us for us, a storm now.
Dr. Future show.
Yes, hope you enjoyed that, folks.
Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, Venus, wherever you are listening. See you next time.